So tonight we're going to be in Revelation chapter 17. We're kind of going to finish chapter 17, and then we'll jump into the first part of chapter 18. And next week, just to let you know, we will kind of hopefully finish chapter 18. There aren't too many more chapters left. You think about this, we're at chapter 18, then 19, 20, 21, and 22. So we've come a long way. So I believe that we will be in the book of Revelation. We'll probably be in the book of Revelation for just over a year. And there's a lot more that we could have said, a lot more that maybe you wish that we would have said. But at least this can at least help you as you kind of wrap your heads around. Again, the whole purpose of going through this is, if you remember way back a year ago, I said a couple things. Number one, that when you start this journey, you will be challenged. I think we all can agree that our understanding of what that day is going to look like when Jesus returns, we may have a little bit different view than when we started a year ago. And I still learn things, even though I keep going through the book of Revelation. There's still things that I learned. There's questions that you ask that I never thought of before. And sometimes I'm just like, well, that's a good question. I'm not sure. And then sometimes I do think about those questions often. But we are kind of coming to the end. The other thing that I strived when we first started is, you know, we got to ask the question of what does the Bible actually say? And that has been the driving force all through this thing, this study, is what are the words? What does it actually say? And what does it actually mean? And there's a lot of symbolism. And again, symbolism is one of those things that, especially on some of the symbolism, we just don't know. And that's okay to admit that. So, but just kind of as review, so chapter 17, where we looked at last week, we have this prostitute, which again is this understanding of this person. Again, it's this lady is not a real lady, but it's a figurative lady about that represents all the wicked and evilness in this world. And you see that especially in this is Revelation chapter 17 verses 5 and 6, not 1 and 2. But it says the call is the name. And it's the Babylon the Great. Now, this isn't the first time that we have seen that title, Babylon the Great. In fact, if you go to today, I was thinking about that, of how many times we have seen that title. And it started way back in Revelation chapter 14, verse 8, where you have the three angels. And the second angel says, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And then in chapter 16, and that's where you get into the bowls of God's wrath, you have the same thing, Babylon the Great. Chapter 17, verse 5 is the one that we're looking at. And then Revelation chapter 18, which is the next chapter, talks about the same thing, Babylon the Great, numerous times. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13 is the only place where Babylon is used in the New Testament. There is one time in Acts where it's talked about Babylon, referring to the actual country of Babylon. But in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13, Peter talks about how the believers in Babylon, not literal city Babylon, but it's the symbolic, and that's why each one of these represents this symbolic Babylon. And again, we have seen over and over again that there is this symbolism throughout Scripture that dates all the way back to Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 through 9, where we have the city of Babel, which becomes Babylon. And then back all the way back then is this understanding of they were building this city to make a name for themselves. And as they didn't want anything to do with God, which is why when you look at especially in New Testament, and again, this is the Alistair Begg quote that I keep kind of, because he kind of defines what Babylon is, how it represents man in his proud defiance against God and determination to construct a society without God. And that symbolism is what we see here in Revelation in these verses. This symbolic understanding of that this Babylon the Great, this society without God, has fallen. And so we see, again, you see that the symbolism with what this woman and what's happening. Let's jump down. Let me jump down to verse 12, and let me read Revelation chapter 17, verse 12 through 18. We'll go to verse 3 first, and then we will dive in here. But the ten horns, you see that the woman and how she is there, and then there's this beast that this woman is riding on, and this beast has seven heads and ten horns. We talked about the seven heads and what that represented. We did not talk about the ten horns, so that's where we'll pick it up now. So the ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but one for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, "The waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, and nations and languages. The beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh, burn her with fire, for God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over to the beast their royal authority until God's words are fulfilled. The woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his glory. With a mighty voice, he shouted, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling for demons and a haunt for every impure spirit, a haunt for every unclean bird, a haunt for every unclean and detestable animal. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the sea grew rich from her excessive luxury.'" So we'll dive in here a little bit. So when you get to this, this beast that she is sitting on, and this image of just how, again, if she represents all of wickedness and the society that is does not want anything to do with God, then you also have this beast then that comes in with the seven heads, and again, those represents different things with the hills and the kings. And again, if you remember last week, you kind of went through what those possible kings could represent, and one is yet to come. But the ten horns here, you see, are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom. So now we're talking about something that is in the future, and how they will receive their authority as kings along with the beast. Now, the beast is referring to what?
Antichrist.
The Antichrist. And so these ten rulers, if you want to say, kings, will be kind of ruling at the same time as the Antichrist. But who is going to be the one in charge, if you want to say? The Antichrist. You see that in verse 13. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. And so these rulers of the world are going to submit themselves to to the beast, the Antichrist. That's what the understanding of they will give. They will allow the Antichrist to rule, and they're going to follow what the Antichrist or what the beast says. They will have one purpose. Verse 13, they will have one purpose, meaning they will be unified. Verse 14, what are they going to be unified around? They're going to make war against whom? The Lamb. They're going to declare war on, of course, the Lamb is who?
Jesus.
In the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, the Lamb always refers to Jesus. So they will make war against the Lamb. But the beast, if you remember the Antichrist, they will wage war against the believers, and they will conquer the believers. Here, they will wage war against the Lamb, but who's going to win? The Lamb. The Lamb will conquer or be triumph or be victorious over the Antichrist and so forth. Why? Because he's Lord. Two titles here. He is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And sometimes, again, we get so used to using these titles that we forget exactly what we're saying when we say, you know, God is Lord of Lords. That was a title that the kings of Babylon used as they were Lord of Lords or King of Kings. In other words, they were the supreme ruler of the entire world. They were the king above all kings. And of course, that's why you have the empires. And they if you look at the go back and look at the history of the Babylonian Empire and how, I mean, they ruled a huge area, and then the Greeks came and conquered it and so forth. And it's that understanding that they are the king above all kings. And that's what these two titles represent, is that Jesus is that supreme ruler. He is greater than any other king in all the world. He will come and he will conquer them. And again, that's good news for us. This understanding that, you know, again, sometimes we look at Revelation, we can get discouraged. We look at all the wickedness and evil around us, and again, we can get discouraged. But the book of Revelation is constantly reminding us that, number one, God's in control, and number two, that God is king of all. He is over all. Nothing that Satan does, nothing that the Antichrist does, nothing that the false prophet does, nothing that they do is more powerful than God, because he is King of Kings and he is Lord of Lords. End of verse 14 says, and with him are whom? The called, chosen, and faithful followers. And again, that's that understanding is those who have persevered to the end. That faithful follower of Jesus Christ. Verse 15, we see kind of a description of this, a little more about this this prostitute. She is sitting where? She's sitting by the waters and is sitting on whom? She sits upon the waters and, sorry, verse 15 explains what the symbolism of that water. So you go back to verse 1 of chapter 17. One of the angels who had the seven bowls came and said, come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits, and again, the NIV will say by, but it's actually upon, who sits upon many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. So in verse 15 explains then that symbolism. The understanding of her sitting there upon the water is that she is literally sitting upon peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. In other words, she is, that her understanding of sitting is that she is in control. She is over the entire world. And again, it makes sense because then you have the beast that she rides on and so forth, the same symbolism. And so you have this understanding that Babylon the Great, again, this is not a literal woman. This is symbolic of the wicked and evilness that is in the world. And so she is now sitting upon in control of all the nations, which means all the nations are what? evil, wicked, going away from God, trying to do and live life apart from God. And we'll see how this all plays out in a little bit more. The other thing, verses 16 and 17, we see then that the beast and the ten horns you saw are going to do what to the prostitute?
Hate her.
So at first, they run after her because she is very wealthy and promises wealth. And again, in verse chapter 18, you see some of this where they kind of lament and be like, oh, I can't believe she's been destroyed. But they run after her, they drink her cup, and part of that is because they think in their mind, if I buy into this wickedness and evilness, I'm going to experience the same luxury and the same wisdom that this system of wickedness and evilness does. But then it comes to the point in time where all of a sudden the beast and these kings are going to turn on her, and they will do what to her in verse 16? They will ruin her. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Interesting thing is so often when you look at the history of nations, the reason why there is so many times a downfall in a nation is because of the corruption, the wickedness in that nation. I mean, we can see what kind of happened last night and even today with some of the things and what the American people did. But we all had a sense, and it wasn't just us, there was a lot of people who were saying this, that our nation is headed in the wrong direction unless something happens and we keep heading down this wicked, sinful, like our nation may get to the point where there's no return. It may be destroyed. That's what happened to Rome. Rome was defeated, yes, because of an outward an attack from the out, but it was mainly defeated because morally it was bankrupt and they didn't have anything to stand on anymore. And that's what happens so many times. Evil often turns on itself and it leads to destruction. So many times you see that. If you don't believe that, just turn on some of the news and you see the fighting amongst people. Of how the Democrats are already trying to put the blame on someone for the reason why they lost. It's not because of whatever, but they're going to pinpoint somebody and be like, you're the reason why. They're fighting amongst themselves. And it's because of this. If the Republicans would have lost, they would have done the same thing. So we don't think the Republicans are. But just so that you know, it's evil often turns on itself and brings destruction. That's exactly what Paul says. You sow what you reap. Do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh, in other words, their sinful flesh, that's what Paul talks about, sinful nature, desires, from the flesh will reap what? Destruction. So if you keep feeding and going after sinful desires, what's going to happen is eventually that's going to lead to destruction. But whoever sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. And this understanding is, and this is where you get the idea where there's, as followers of Jesus Christ, there's, Paul talks about in Romans, there's this battle. Sometimes we feel like there's a battle going on inside of us. Paul talks about, I want to do good, but I don't always do it. And the things I don't want to do, I do. And there's this constant tension going on. And what happens so many times, and this is what I forget what psychologist says this, but sometimes you feel like there's like two dogs in our lives, and whatever dog we feed, if we feed the good dog, then that gets stronger, and they're constantly battling with each other. Now we can say that about, of course, through the power of the Holy Spirit, God enables us to make sure that we walk in, and that's what Paul is saying here in Galatians, that we are to walk, keep in step with the Spirit, and not allow the flesh, our fleshly desires, to control us anymore. And so you have this understanding that if you, wickedness, sinfulness always leads to destruction. And that's exactly what you see here. You have these the Antichrist, and you have these other kings that are submitting themselves to the Antichrist. The whole world is unified around this wickedness and evil, what's going on. And eventually what's going to happen is it's going to lead to destruction, to the point where this woman, Babylon the Great, this wicked systems of the world will come to an end. Verse 17. For God has put it into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to hand over to the beast the royal authority until God's words are what? Fulfilled, complete. In other words, God knows when this is going to happen. It's upon his timetable. And when that time happens, then the evil, wicked world that we live in will come to an end. And that's what this prostitute, this Babylon the Great woman, this whole chapter 17 symbolic is a reminder that we live in a world that is bent towards evil. And the kings of this world, the politicians of this world, they run after this wickedness, this evil, the systems of this world, because they look at it and, I mean, it looks good, not realizing that they're really selling their souls. Because that's what you get into chapter 18 now, and you see some more of this symbolism of, okay, Babylon the Great comes to an end. This wicked, evil system, world that we live in comes to the end, is destroyed. And now we have this, the people crying out that have bought into the sinful, wicked systems of this world. Verse 1 of chapter 18. So there's another angel from heaven, and this angel comes with a loud voice and begins to say, again, this is not something that we haven't seen before. The very first words of chapter 2, verse 2, are fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great. The interesting thing is about that is when you look at this section, these three verses 2 and 3 in 18, the book of Revelation actually echoes Isaiah's prophecies. And then we're going to look at two prophecies here that deal with Babylon. And when Isaiah's talking about Babylon, he's talking about real Babylon. Okay, so we have to think to keep that in mind. But when you look at what Isaiah says about real Babylon and the destruction of the real city of Babylon, and then you look at, again, the symbolism and how John and this angel talks about the destruction of Babylon the Great, you'll see that it is very similar, and we can actually see some of the meaning behind what the angel is saying. So we're going to look into the book of Isaiah here. We start in Isaiah chapter 21, verses 1 through 10. So, Isaiah chapter 21. A little bit different if you follow along there. So God comes to Isaiah and says, there's going to be a time when the city of Babylon is going to be destroyed. And part of that is, you look at kind of verse 3, 4, and 5, is, especially verse 5, the people in Babylon are they're setting tables, they spread out the rugs, they eat, they drink, they're having a grand old time. And that's exactly what happens when you go to the book of Daniel and you see they are having a grand old feast, and then the hand on the wall comes and writes, and Daniel comes in and says, This very night, the city of Babylon is going to be taken over, and that's exactly what happens. And so you then have this verses 6 and 7, you have this guy who is posted up on the tower, the watchtower. That's what they did. And he sees this army coming. That's not what actually happened, in the sense of the Persian, the Medes, conquered the city of Babylon, and they were not paying attention. And so that's this kind of a prophecy there, dealing with how you know that God is going to is showing Isaiah that the battle, that the army is going to come and destroy them. But then you have the lookout, the verse 8, shouting, and he says, look, here comes a man in a chariot with a team of horses. He gives back the answer, and what does he yell? Babylon has fallen, has fallen. And again, when you look at the time of Isaiah, no one would have guessed that the city of Babylon would have fallen, because that was the most powerful nation in that world right at that point in time, which is why they thought we're indestructible. So let's just have this grand old party and they let their guards down. And that very night they came in and destroyed them. And again, God prophesied that there was going to come a time when Babylon was going to be destroyed. Now, when you look at the book of Isaiah, you have to realize that not all the prophecies are in chronological order. And so when you go back to Isaiah chapter 13, there is another prophecy that deals with Babylon, a little bit more detail about what's going to happen to the city of Babylon when it gets destroyed. I'll read this one because it's a little bit longer. But especially when you get towards the end of chapter 13, you will see some of the similar terminology of what's going to happen to their homes, what's going to happen, who's going to be living in the city of Babylon. And I'll give you a hint, it's not people. And then we will come to the book of Revelation, and you'll see this angel uses the exact same imagery of what's going to happen. Again, Revelation, symbolic of Babylon the Great, dealing with the understanding of wickedness, society, evilness. Isaiah prophecy deals with the city, because of Babylon was an actual city in Isaiah. So verse 1 of chapter 13 of Isaiah, prophecy against Babylon that Isaiah, son of Amoz, saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop, shout to them, beckon on to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded those I prepared for battle. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath, those who rejoice in my triumph. Listen, a noise on the mountains like that of a great multitude. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms, like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from a faraway land, from the ends of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his wrath to destroy the whole country. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every heart will melt with fear. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other and their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within. So God is prophesying about the actual city of Babylon. And up to this point in time, what is Isaiah saying about this actual city of Babylon? What's going to happen to them? It's going to be destroyed, because who's going to destroy it? God is. And some of that has to go back with because of how they treated the nation of Israel. And again, you can look into other, especially the other prophets that deal with that. That God used the Assyrian Empire to come and conquer the northern kingdom, and to bring judgment upon his own people. That's why God did that. Because of their sin, because of their wickedness, God brought the Assyrians to come and conquer his own people. God does the same thing with the Babylonians. God brings the Babylonians to judge and conquer his own people, to send them into exile because of their sin, because of their disobedience. But there's prophecies, and you read the, especially the Torah, like what we call the minor prophets, when you read them, you realize that the Assyrians and the Babylonians, because of their severe mistreatment to the nation of Israel, now God is going to come and judge them and wipe them out. And that's what we've read here so far, is that God Almighty is going to come and judge the city of Babylon and cause the city of Babylon to become desolate. Verse 10, the stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I'll put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. Verse 12, I will make people scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Orpher. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble and the earth will shake from its place as the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of his burning anger. Like a hunted gazelle, like sheep without a shepherd, they will all return to their own people. They will flee to their native land. Whoever is captured will be thrust through. All who are caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be looted and their wives violated. Verse 17, here is the nation that's going to do this. See, I will stir up against them who? The Medes. And that's exactly what happened. Man, this is years before Babylon falls. See, I will stir up against them the Medes, who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Their bows will strike down the young men. They will have no mercy on infants, nor will they look with compassion on children. Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the pride and glory of the Babylonians, will be overthrown by whom? By God. Again, God is the one orchestrating all this. He is bringing judgment upon the Babylonians for how they mistreated the nation of Israel. He's raising up the Medes, the Medo-Persian Empire, to do just that. He'll do it like Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 20, she will never be inhabited or lived in through all generations. There are no nomads will pitch their tents. There are no shepherds will rest their flocks, but desert creatures will lie there. Jackals will fill their houses. There the owls will dwell. There the wild goats will leap about. Hyenas will inhabit her strongholds. Jackals her luxurious palaces. There her time is at hand, and her days will not be prolonged. The Lord will have compassion on Jacob once again, and he will choose Israel and will settle them in their own land. Foreigners will join them and unite with the descendants of Jacob. Nations will take them and bring them to their own place. And Israel will take possession of the nations and make them male and female servants in the Lord's land. They will make captives of their captors and rule over their oppressors. And there's more that you want to read on in chapter 14. So God's going to come, wipe out the city of Babylon. And who's going to live in their homes? Animals. God is going to, and that's what the understanding of, he's going to do it like Sodom and Gomorrah. In other words, God is going to wipe them out and totally destroy what's happened there. And he realized, I mean, that is exactly what happens. The city of Babylon does get destroyed. And now you flip back to chapter 18 with that kind of context, and you see chapter 18, verse 2. Fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place for what? Demons. A haunt or a prison for every what? Impure spirit. And then you have unclean birds. Again, unclean birds is referring to the Old Testament law, unclean animals. The animals that God said, you know, if you touch, you become ceremonially unclean. That's why it's unclean. every unclean and detestable animal. So that we're talking about, again, the prophecy of God's going to come to the city of Babylon, the actual city of Babylon in Isaiah, and totally wipe them out. To the place where the people are destroyed, to the place where their houses are destroyed, to the place where there's no, it's uninhabitable except for the wild animals. Here, you have God coming and wiping out this wicked, sinful world to the place where, again, it is totally wiped out. There's no more. Verse 3, for all the nations have drunk the madding wine. Again, this is similar language from back in chapter 14, that understanding of, you know, all the nations went after her and thought that if they could, they went after her and loved her and drank the wine that she had in her cup, and it actually made them mad and not wise. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her. It's understanding, again, symbolic of when the nation of Israel followed after false gods. They were committing, as God says, they were committing adultery to him. They were the unfaithful spouse. And it's the same understanding. The kings were going after, and not God, but they were going after her. The merchants of the earth, they grew rich from her what? Excessive luxuries. And again, you think of our world and the screwed up world we live in. Wicked people seem to prosper, right? And righteous people, or people who try to live right, a lot of times they're the ones that get beat up. And if you see this exactly through the political systems, you look at, and again, it doesn't matter, Democrat or Republican, doesn't matter, but if you look at some of these people that have been in our governments for decades, and you look at just kind of shaking your head and thinking, how in the world did they become millionaires when serving in Congress? How in the world do you go from a person who seems to have good morals to all of a sudden 10 years in Congress now is voting for stuff? You're just shaking your head and thinking, what in the world? And this is that time where the Revelation kind of peels back that curtain a little bit and says, well, they're running after Babylon the Great. Because in their minds, in their twisted mind, they think, if I want to get ahead in this world, if I want to be rich and be wealthy and to get all this elaborate lifestyle, then I need to be friends with this wicked world. You think of Hollywood actors and stuff. Same thing. There was several years ago, there was a Christian actor did an interview. I forget what movie he starred in. It was one of the God's Not Dead ones. They were talking to him, and they asked the person who was doing the interview asked him. It was a Christian guy who was doing the interview. And he was talking to him about his faith and how can he be a Christian in Hollywood kind of discussion. And the guy asked him, is it hard to be a Christian in Hollywood? And he said, yes, because you are pressured to compromise your morals to be able to star in some of these movies, to do things that you would never would have comprehended that you would be doing, just so that you could either A, make ends meet, or so that you could star in or be in a movie that is popular. He said, in some ways, you feel like you're selling your soul to be a Christian in Hollywood. And again, it's that our world is bent towards evil. And it looks good. The lifestyle looks good. But at the end of the day, it leads to destruction. And that's what you have Babylon the Great and that symbolism. You have these first three verses in chapter 18 that deals with this understanding that this wicked evil systems of this world that is driving this world, God says, and all of heaven says, it has come to an end. One final thing as we, so verse 4, let me read verse 4. We'll talk more about this next week as we dive in a little bit more. But then it says, verse 4, then I heard another voice from heaven say, and what does the voice say? Come out of her, my people. Now, the thing, interesting thing is this, is that people look at that verse and they're like, oh, here's the rapture. This is not referring to the rapture, okay? So when you look at the symbolism, you have this understanding of this woman in this wicked, sinful world, and you have this call, and of course, my people is referring to believers, and is saying, no, come out of her. And the reason why you're to come out of her is so that you will not share in her sins. That is, the understanding share means that you will not be associated with her, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, in other words, judgment. And what really is this what the angel is doing to believers is this. It is referring to the fact that followers of Jesus Christ are to be in this world, but not of this world, and not to participate in the wicked and sinful wickedness systems of this world. And that's what Jesus says in John chapter 17. And everything is interesting, even the people that, even scholars that believe that the church doesn't go through the book of Revelation, they definitely don't see the rapture in this verse where it says come out. People that believe the church goes through the book of Revelation, of course, don't see that. And the reason why everybody sees this as this understanding of the church is supposed to be separate, it's supposed to be different than the wicked systems of this world, is because it's a different word. So when you look at the word come out, it literally is, you know, come out, you know, go outside. You go outside, come out, so forth. Whereas the other word in 1 Thessalonians is to snatch, to grab and seize. Like if a police officer is trying to arrest somebody, that's that word, is that they seize them in a way. So that's a totally different understanding. But it's that understanding that as believers in Jesus Christ, we are not to participate. We're supposed to be in this world, but not of this world. As we close, let me read what Jesus says there in John chapter 17. It says Jesus is called the Upper Room Discourse. So when you look at the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, when Jesus is there in the upper room, he's having the conversation with his disciples there. And when you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it's a very short conversation. You think, oh man, Jesus didn't really spend that much time with his disciples in the upper room. Well, when you look at the Gospel of John, he kind of flushes things out. In fact, the upper room discourse starts all the way, and the reason why I call it the upper room discourse is because it is a long teaching time of Jesus. In fact, it goes all the way to chapter 13. John chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 is when Jesus is either in the upper room or he is on his way, and it's the same conversation that Jesus is having with his disciples as he is either in the upper room or as he's walking to the Garden of Gethsemane. And then chapter 18 is when he gets arrested. But it's one long conversation that Jesus has. And in John chapter 17, verse 13, it says this. So Jesus is praying, chapter 17, he's praying for his disciples. First he prays for himself, then he prays for the disciples around him, and then he prays for his future disciples like you and I. But verse 13, it says, I am coming to you now. So this is prayer. He's talking to his Heavenly Father, and that's what the you is referring to. I am coming to you now. But I say these things while I am still in the world, so that they may have the full measure of my joy within them. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, for they are not of the world, any more than I am of the world. My prayer is not that you take them out of the world. In other words, Jesus isn't praying that we isolate ourselves and become isolationists and build bunkers and do all that. Jesus says, I'm not asking you to take them out of the world, but that you protect them or you keep them from whom? The evil one. From Satan. They are not of the world, just as I am not of it. Sanctify them and set them apart by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so you think about this, God sends his Son into this world to come and dwell on this planet, to live upon this world, to die upon the cross, and to rise again 3 days later. Jesus says, as you have sent me into this world, I have sent them into the world, and I sanctify myself, that they too may be sanctified by the truth. And this is that understanding of, yes, we are living in this physical, sinful, fallen, wicked world, and wickedness abounds, and as we get to the end of Jesus, closer to Jesus' return, more and more wickedness will abound. And that verse there in chapter 18 of Revelation, God is saying, don't participate. Don't be caught up in this sinful world. You are not, yes, you're in this world, but you are not of this world. Do not be associated by their sin. Do not be associated by this wickedness. Do not be associated or do it because what happens so that you do not receive her judgment. You're in this world, but not of this world. We'll talk more about what's happening in chapter 18 as the chapter goes on with different people who cry out because of this wicked, sinful world is coming to the end and is being destroyed. And they made a killing off of this wicked, sinful world, and that's what happens in chapter 18. You have people who have become very wealthy, who are yelling out and mourning because of this wicked, sinful world has come to an end. And that's what's going on there with the rest of the chapter. So we'll talk about that more.